Okay, welcome back everyone. It was a little bit of a hiatus, I think, between Pesach and then and Yom HaAtzmaut and everything else. So welcome back to all, including new faces. Nice to see you. So what we're going to do tonight and then next time, God willing, as well, is to picking up in the spirit of Yom HaAtzmaut and this time of year, and then leading toward Yom Yerushalayim, sort of reflecting on that, is to examine a classic essay of Rav Soloveitchik called Gedida Fake. Also perfect for, we've been discussing different topics in Jewish philosophy and Torah Mada, and this is perfect right up that alley. So before we jump in, I just want to give some background, and then we'll be taking some, at least pieces, some excerpts of it and beginning our discussion, and then God willing, next time again, we'll continue. We'll probably do this over two classes. You could do it over probably four or five pretty seriously, but at least we'll get, I think, a good feel for what the Rav is trying to do in what became an immediate classic among a number of classic essays of the Rav. So Kol Gedida Fake is delivered in 1956 on Yom HaAtzmaut at Yeshiva University. Originally, I can't imagine that he said all of this at Yeshiva University in a Sicha on Yom HaAtzmaut. If he did, yeah, I was going to say, it might not have ended. It was a two-day Yom HaAtzmaut. They were machmir for both Shitas and both state. Okay. So anyhow, this is quite long. He actually originally published in Hebrew. This is a translation, not directly the language of the Rav. It was translated by Professor Lawrence Kaplan of Montreal. Professor Kaplan also translated Halachic Man, which is another classic work of the Rav, and I think that the translation is considered to be faithful, and I think not only to the content, but really to the spirit of what the Rav is trying to do. I think it's a vigorous read, it's engaging, and it really communicates really effectively and even poetically at times. In terms of context, so 1956, so we're just a handful of years really in the aftermath of the Shoah and then the creation of the State of Israel. So it's really still a very formative time in Jewish history. The truth is, at that time, just some 11 years out, it's fair to say that at least in terms of the literature, in terms of the output, with regard to reflections on the Holocaust, which is the subtitle of the Rav, if you take a look, actually I don't know if it came out in these photocopies.
Wait, so it's two together.
It's
That's
those.
Why it's so long.
No, those are footnotes.
Oh my God!
I'm sorry. Yeah. You said 11 years out.
No, it's not.
No, it's repeated.
No, it's repeated.
What is?
Starting here, page 51. This is stapled to
it's
together.
It's still long. It's just.
Where?
See, if this page was like this.
One more page.
Oh, that's weird.
After 115.
No, it came out backward, that's why. No, it's not. No,
maybe some of them are and some of them aren't.
I don't know. It doesn't look like the pages are marked.
Yeah, no, they're double. What? They do. It's just the way that
backwards.
They go back and forth. It's the way that it is.
So it's like whenever it was done, because this is on the back of the previous one.
Yeah, it doubled up. I don't know why. I didn't know actually had someone else take care of
it.
What? It's all good. You can cut it off. It's all good. So the just some background though, to continue on the background. So there was the sense that just a few years after the Holocaust and the founding of the State of Israel, that even the Holocaust itself had not necessarily been fully digested by the Jewish community, by the world community. The wounds were extremely fresh. In fact, you find a lot of literature in the 1960s reflecting on the Shoah and sort of asking all the basic questions that you might have expected would have been asked earlier, but a lot of the Holocaust literature doesn't really start to emerge until late 50s, early 60s, and that's where some of the really big, heavy questions begin to be asked in a fuller kind of way, in a more widespread fashion. Of course, you have people asking questions and discussing, but there's almost a sense that there was this sort of trauma that just so swept our people that we almost couldn't begin to
it's not the
even
same thing that
grapple
said about,
in the same way.
You know, after the destruction of the temple, the real kind of discussions didn't happen until like some years after because of the same kind of. I remember what's her name? Somebody who was like an expert in this, Eric Lincoln, talking about like the Midrash. The shock, it's too hard to mm-hmm. process, hard to comment on it.
Right.
So it has to come after some time has passed.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not familiar in terms of the time, the Second Temple period.
Yeah.
I think through that. I don't know the parallel offhand, but... I think we can understand it.
I
did. It's unfortunate that that's not copy. I'm just trying to figure out what happened with these soda copies, but I'll figure it out. This is going to be a journey. Oh, that's all good. Yeah, go ahead, Alicia.
No, I'm saying that 67, the way that war is framed,
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. I think that's when they sort of coupled this, mm-hmm. Looking at the Shoah, looking at the state, mm-hmm. and now in 67, mm-hmm. with that victory being what it was,
mm-hmm.
And then there's, you know, there's 73, we have Munich, then you have Yom Kippur War, like
right.
these things sort of
mm-hmm.
starting to establish a state.
Mm-hmm.
There's that. But yeah, I agree with Robin. I think that is just a matter of
mm-hmm.
that first generation's not going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the second.
Right. So the Rav sort of qualifies for that. He was born in 1903. He was certainly not a kid by any stretch. But what he, that's where right before, or just before, it's 1956, but just before, the Rav at the same time escapes. He was in America earlier. The family came over, so it's not so much the age for him, but it's more that he doesn't experience it firsthand, and so he's able to kind of reflect in that way. So this is framed as reflections on the Holocaust, but at the same time, it's clearly not only a theological work. It's also very much as we'll see later on, an indictment of sort of a very open and honest critique of the American Orthodox Jewish community for what the Rav saw as its sort of passivity in the face of some of the challenges that the fledgling state posed. The Rav saw the Holocaust not only through a theological prism, but also as an American who lived at that time, who was trying to grapple with what he saw was, again, passivity of the American Jewish community during the time of the Holocaust. He was critical of a number of prominent American politicians, as many members of the Jewish community were afterwards, took too long, and all of that, Truman Roosevelt, etc. But he was also critical of the American Jewish community. And now, just a few short years later, so the State of Israel is 8 years old, its existence remains from an economic perspective, from a security perspective, one that is open. There's an open question in terms of the viability of Medina Israel. Is our community doing enough? So that was the Rav's perspective. He didn't hold back any punches. He's honest, but he does it in the most beautiful, uplifting, moving way, and then he's direct when he wants to be direct. But the way that he frames this critique is so moving, is so beautiful, is so overarching, that it became an instant classic in high schools in particular, in America, in modern Orthodox high schools, not so much in Haredi American high schools, believe it or not. But in Israel as well. Again, it was originally published in Hebrew. It is currently a staple of Israeli high school curricula. You go through the Mamlachti Dati high school system, almost certainly going to be exposed to this, and it's an extremely complex and layered essay. So what I want to do is to begin to go through, to kind of give an overview, and to examine some of the key pieces of the Rav's presentation here. The Rav begins, what we see here is not only him as a philosopher and as a public person, as a public figure, but also as a gorgeous writer. You just see the language, and this is in translation, and it comes across beautifully. See what? Lawrence Kaplan mentions. It's absolutely gorgeous. And the Rav also, as a talented orator, knows to begin without sort of giving disinteresting platitudes or asking old questions in a boring kind of way, but jumping right in. So the Rav, instead of giving an overview, he immediately jumps in with the question of none other than theodicy. The Rav begins by observing one of the darkest... What?
Translated?
This is originally in Hebrew. The Rav published it for whatever reason in Hebrew, because I think he felt that it was a Zionist.
In Hebrew,
no, yeah. That's true, but he said it.
He delivered it in what?
He delivered it
in English originally, but he published it, I believe so.
Okay.
You know what? It's possible back in 1956. Actually, I don't know for certain. It's entirely possible it was in Yiddish. The Rav spoke in Yiddish most of the time until the 60s, and then he switched over to English. That was his mother tongue. So it's actually entirely, I'm not certain, it was entirely possible it was in Yiddish, published in Hebrew, and then translated into the English.
But it's not possible that it's in English?
If you compare it, we have it published in the Hebrew. Oh. It's in one of the classic Hebrew collections of the Rav. It's word for word.
When he delivered it in English, then he rewrote it and published it. In other words, he said one thing in English, then he mm-hmm.
It was clearly expanded. I'm sure the footnotes didn't make it into the original oral presentation. I don't think. Yeah, he didn't say all of this, but it's based on that, and he published it. Published it soon afterward. No, all good. So the Rav begins by observing that one of the darkest enigmas with which Judaism has struggled from the very dawn of its existence is the problem of suffering in the world. He says this is not a new problem. The question of theodicy. If this is an essay reflection entitled "Reflections on the Holocaust," theodicy is clearly an appropriate way in. And so he jumps in immediately in exactly that way. Already Moses, the master of the prophets, in a moment of mercy and grace of divine acceptance, pleaded with the Lord that he enlighten him concerning this obscure matter. Moses knocks at the gates of heaven, where he asks his question. And then the Rav continues. He says, it's not just Moshe Rabbeinu who asks this question. It's some of the greatest of the other prophets that were subsequent to Moshe Rabbeinu. Habakkuk, Yirmiyahu, and so on and so forth. And of course, Iyov, the entire book of Job, to which the Rav dedicates some of the emphasis at the beginning of this essay, really hones in and focuses on that question. So the Rav goes on, and he essentially then comes to the question of not only what theodicy is and what the problem is, but how do we respond? And the Rav here already begins with the novelty in his approach. The Rav says there are actually two very different ways to think about and to respond to this question. He says there's one question, which is the why. And there's another question which he calls the what. What's the difference between the why question and the what question? What does that mean?
Why cause and effect.
Good.
What is the nature of...
Okay. What is the nature?
Whatever.
Okay. So the Rav, as a halachist par excellence, says that essentially exactly 100% is that essentially you have two very different ways to ask this question. The why question is what he calls, he doesn't use this language, but it's essentially, he thinks, not the halachic question, it's a legitimate question. Anyone who goes through suffering has every right to ask why. It could be, right? It could be a national catastrophe, it could be a personal loss, it could be anything. The question of why is a completely legitimate question. Judaism asks it, people ask it, and halakha endorses that question. But he says, ultimately, the answer to the why question is beyond us. He says, as human beings, reflecting on the Holocaust in particular, but in the face of any tragedy, to think that we are going to find the answer to this question is illusory, is foolishness, is frankly arrogance. There's no way. God has his reasons, and let's not waste our time or trick anyone into imagining that we can begin to plumb the depths of anything that approaches understanding the metaphysical why suffering happens in this world. And so the Rav insists, he says, and there are some approaches that claim that, well, what we're going to say is that suffering doesn't exist. right? It's illusory. It appears that there's evil in the world, and really, it's all good. It's all good. The Rav says, Judaism is a very realistic approach to this world. To deny that suffering is real, to deny that suffering exists in this world, is just not the halachic way. Judaism has, halacha has, an extremely realistic approach to our existence. So then what do we do with suffering, says the Rav? If we just focus on the why question, all we do is we spin our wheels around and around and around, and where are we going to go with this? And how are we going to begin to take those steps forward? He says, because this is an endless cycle that's not ultimately going to get anywhere, it might be healthy for one to ask those questions, but is that all? Here the Rav says, the novel insight of Judaism is to say that the question can also be asked on a different plane, namely that of the what. And the question of what, as Barthes says, is not just, or not so much, how did this come about or why did this come about, but rather, it is a charge to us to ask ourselves the question, what can we do with this? Right? What can we make of this suffering? This is the halakhic approach. It's one that looks not backward, but looks forward. That asks yourself not so much, right? How do we account for all that? Because we ain't ever going to account for all that. It's just not going to happen. But rather, how do we make something of this? What is our charge? Which doesn't necessarily require us to understand why God what he did. If we did, I assume that would make the what much easier to answer. But we don't have that insight. So the Rav says the charge of Judaism is to take the suffering and to somehow grant its legitimacy, grant that it's real, grant that there's true pain in this world and that those are legitimate questions, but then to also encourage us and allow us to ask, what can we do with this? How can we take the suffering and somehow in some way allow us to grow through that experience? And so the Rav says, if you take a look now on page 54, in the next bracket. So here the Rav says, right, he's concluding the first one, the why question, so immediately before the bracket that you have here, in a word he says, the eye of fate asks a theoretical metaphysical question regarding evil, and this question has no answer, it is insoluble. So that's the why question. But then the Rav continues and says that in the second dimension of human existence, destiny, the problem of suffering assumes a new form. Right? So he's distinguishing here between what he called fate and destiny, which are aligned with the questions of why and what. He says the question of fate is essentially what is going to happen to us no matter what. Or that which has been declared by the stars, as it were, astrologically speaking, and that's our fate. There's nothing we can do with it. And that's where we're spinning our wheels. So that's the why question. The aspect of destiny, though, the Rav says, that's the what question. That's what, not where we came from or how we got here, but rather what we can possibly begin to do with this experience as we move forward in our lives. So that's what he calls destiny. What is the nature of the existence of destiny? It is an active mode of existence, says the Rav. One wherein man confronts the environment into which he was thrown, possessed of an understanding of his uniqueness, of his special worth, of his freedom, and of his ability to struggle with his external circumstances without forfeiting either his independence or his selfhood. Right? So what's the difference between an existence of fate on the one hand and that of destiny on the other? Right? So one, in the former, humanity is
passive.
Right, is passive. In the latter, active. In the former, I'm an object. In the latter, I am a subject, right? An active person. And that's really the fundamental difference. And then if you jump down to the fourth to last line in the section, and actually I have a family member, my brother-in-law, who actually has this as the... He loved this line so much that he put this as below the signature of his email. So, right? You know, some people put quotations. So this was his quotation. This is it. He says, man's task in this world, according to Judaism, is to transform fate into destiny, right? See why my brother-in-law might have done that. A passive existence into an active existence, an existence of compulsion, perplexity, and muteness, into an existence replete with a powerful will, with resourcefulness, daring, and imagination. I think that's where he cut it off. That was funny. right? But it's, right? It's a man's task is to transform fate into destiny. And that's an incredibly powerful kind of idea. God's blessing to the world, to the work of his hands, sums up their entire purpose in life. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Subdue the environment and subject it to your control. If you do not rule over it, it will subjugate you. Destiny bestows upon man a new rank in God's world. It presents him with a royal crown. Man becomes transformed into a partner with the Almighty and the act of creation. So for the Rav, the response to human suffering and this notion of destiny and not only fate to transform the fate into destiny goes to a cardinal principle, a fundamental question as to humanity's place in the world. Are we just subject to the whims of fate that oversweep us, or are we able to actually actively partner with God in this world? It's a completely different perspective with regard to the place of the human being in the constellations, right? In the universe of creation, yeah.
Let me just think how to phrase it. My question is the effect on free will and determinism of this approach. I think mm-hmm. you know the approach of the fate is kind of looking backwards, mm-hmm. saying we can't understand the past. Mm-hmm. Your destiny says what do we do in the future?
Right.
But my question is, once you roll time forward, you know, if you've had somebody before the Holocaust in Kristallnacht and say what's our destiny is to do whatever it is we can do, and then roll forward X number of years and look back and say, well, that didn't work. You know, you still get steamrolled by fate.
Mm-hmm.
And with the perspective of hindsight, you see that what perceived to be your destiny, you know, it's kind of, what's it talk about fate and it's kind of determinism, which, mm-hmm. you know, it's you know very close to it.
Right.
It's very hard to look back and say, well, what right. I thought was destiny was actually illusory, possibly.
Right, 100%. And anyone who experienced any sort of any experience, yeah, go ahead.
It's not exactly accurate, that assessment, even though there's a lot of weight and merit.
Mm-hmm.
There are still many, many examples when people saw what's coming, especially if you were in Germany in the 1930s or even before. Little by little, Germans don't do everything like overnight. They prepare, they set it up, from that is that it's given, the signs are there, you have to like just be attuned to it. I compare it to today's whole you know, nonsense with militant Islam is that giving us so many clues already and everybody sits and waits what happens next. So it's like I had a chutzpah to say that it's Hashem's way to actually create kibbutz galiyot in reality, because how else the wealthy Jewish people in America would decide to pack up and move to Eretz Yisrael?
Mm-hmm.
Only through guys like Al-Qaeda and others like that. Unfortunately, because nobody would do it on their own.
Right. My question is a general question. If we're always looking back and saying right. that was fate, then it doesn't matter what we do looking forward, because in the future we're going to look back on it and say, you right. can't understand it was fate.
Right. I think it's a great question. I appreciate that as well. I think what the Rav would say is that destiny is whatever gap there is between the stimulus and my response. To borrow from
that's the free will point. Is that what this is?
Well, it was more. It was more. It's a little bit of that, but it's also it's Stephen Covey. Also,
yeah.
7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I'm sure you saw that coming. Which is he's one of the Gedolei Bali Hamusar. And that I mean pretty seriously with a little bit, with a lab deal, but 7. He one of I'm a big fan. So one of the ideas in 7 Habits of Highly Effective People is he talks about. I think it's the first habit is to, he says, the highly effective people focus on that which is within their sphere of influence, and the highly effective ones then know the difference between that which is completely beyond their sphere of influence, and they don't take time just spinning their wheels trying to change and get angry and frustrated because all that does is eat me alive and doesn't allow me to be productive. But what they do is they also, because they're focused on being productive, they also manage to expand their sphere of influence. So I can't say that the Rav gave a haskama to Stephen Covey, but I would say that
Stephen Covey read the Rub.
Well, he was maybe the other way around, right? Well, the Rub was older.
He was a big fan of Judaism.
He was from Mormon, a very from Mormon. But just to point out, Stephen Covey, he was a supporter of Israel. He also would fast periodically. He accepted personal fast days. Actually, just saw that the Mormon Church in Baltimore accepted fast day.
Yeah.
It was an unfortunate circumstance, but there are echoes. Anyhow, that's a separate discussion. I think what the Rav might say though is that not so much whatever is happening. The question is sort of given whatever it is that happens that's against our will, wherever we have the option to choose how to respond, how is it? And it's more of an internal quality rather than an external one. The Rav is describing here.
And how we to view our response in the future, looking back, do we view our responses as we had an effect, we made a difference, and therefore it's not totally fate?
I think, in other words, the difference is the Rav's not talking about political activism necessarily. No. The Rav's talking about my own character.
Right.
Only I have control over that. I think that's what he would say. It's also another relevant work is Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl, which is a very moving Holocaust work, which all about the psychologists here, on the basis of which he founded an entirely new movement, right, of logotherapy, and basically people come to him for therapy, and he would enable them to find meaning and to find a purpose in life. And once they honed in on what was their purpose in life, that was what got them through. So
it's very subjective.
So the Rav would say that certain not all goals are created equal. I don't think that Frankl would necessarily say that. He wasn't from but again, I think that the Rav, it's more of an internal quality rather than the political effects. So then the Rav takes this dichotomy and he suggests that the greatest single biblical work, which is overwhelmingly addressing the issue dedicated to exploring the subject of theodicy, namely the book of Iyov, the book of Job, in fact, on the Rav's reading, is really about exactly this thesis. And the Rav doesn't go through every single passage in every single chapter. It's just even just translating the words of Iyov beyond the first two and the final two chapters is incredibly difficult. But basically, the Rav sees the story of Iyov as going something along the following lines. He says, Iyov suffers, and the friends try to counsel him. And he says the fundamental problem or shortcoming of Iyov and his friends was their attitude toward what they did with suffering, and also, prior to that on the rabbinic reading, with success as well. So the Rav says that the fundamental error of Iyov was, on Chazal's reading, he was a wealthy man, he was a prominent member of the community, he was a shofet, he was a judge during that period of time. He was an outstanding individual who also gave, on Chazal's reading at least, gave generously to the Jewish community. What then happens? So according to the Midrashic interpretation, there's a famine, and essentially what he does is he turns his back on his people, and he abandons the land of Israel also, which is a piece of it, and essentially he doesn't care, right, or the community in Israel, and he doesn't care for his community in the way that he was obligated to. So essentially what the Rav says is that what was happening for Iyov was this split, this dichotomy, that his approach to chesed, to tzedakah, was sort of surface deep, was extrinsic or external to his persona. He saw a need, he said, okay, let me throw money at it and let me help to try to support the causes in my community, let me be an active community member, and all that was wonderful and good. But says the Rav, that wasn't enough. The fundamental error, shortcoming of Iyov at the beginning and throughout the work in his conversations with his friends is that he doesn't feel a sense of true identity, of empathy with his people. What the Torah wants from the Baal Tzedakah, for the community leader or any member of the Jewish people, is not only to go through the actions of giving and kindness, that's crucial, but more than that, to truly empathize. When there's something that goes wrong for the Jewish people, is it part of who we are? Do we have sleepless nights? Do we therefore feel compelled to do something? Not because we want to check off a box and make ourselves feel good about our having done what we need to do as people of means or something like that, but rather because we just feel compelled to do so because they are us and I am they, and we're just one people. That sense that we're really one and the same. And that sense of true empathy was fundamentally lacking from Iyov. And you see the conversations with his friend, and the Rav believes that that was his shortcoming, that was his error. And the Rav also believes that what Eov was doing wrong throughout the book was focusing on essentially his faith. And that the Rav does, what Eov does throughout the course of the book with his friends is he philosophizes and he asks only the question of why. And that's a legitimate question, but ultimately, when all is said and done,
it doesn't
get him anywhere, exactly. It may be helpful in terms of on the psychological side of things, but in terms of now how to live his life in a different, renewed kind of way, it doesn't take him where he needs to go. And so therefore the Rav does is when he reads the final prakim of Eov, and you can take a look yourself, but essentially the way that he reads the resolution to the book is that when Eov has the conversation with his friends, he recognizes that we need to stop asking the question of why, and we need to ask the question of what, not in the sense of what sense can I make of the suffering, i.e. why did it happen, and what can I learn to do differently so that I won't suffer in the future? Because we can't understand exactly why it is that Eov suffered the way he can. But what he can do is take the experience of suffering and elevate it and use it in a cathartic way. And to say, you know what, now I'm someone who suffered as well. And if I know what it is to suffer, then maybe there are other people, my brethren, who also are experiencing suffering. And maybe I can come just a step closer to understanding what it is that they're going through so that when I have the opportunity to perhaps restore my original life, which he has come, which is exactly what happens, now he's going to approach it in a very different kind of way, with true empathy, not just sort of this external surface level sympathy. That's fundamentally the story of what Eov is all about, yeah. Granny was waiting on him. Go ahead.
I just have two questions.
Yeah.
One is that the Rav sort of critiques that we shouldn't be asking why that question, but yet he kind of asks why with Job, gives you an answer. He gives you an answer to why Job is suffering. He's suffering because he doesn't feel the empathy for the other. So though he doesn't want us to ask that question, he's kind of answering that question. So that's question one. And the second thing is his critique seems to be that, you know, this whole critique is that we can't be passive as a community, we have to be active. Mm-hmm. Right? So Job, you could say, is active. He does mm-hmm. give the tzedakah.
Right.
He does invite the Shabbos guests mm-hmm. over mm-hmm. and even mm-hmm. rubs some lich and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What he's not doing is he's not feeling.
Right.
He's not feeling the empathy. So the critique that Rav Soloveitchik is, the general critique is that we need to be more active. But mm-hmm. the Job critique is right. not about activity, it's not about action, it's about
right.
feeling, which seems like
right.
a very different kind of critique. So that's why.
Great question. I just want to respond to that. I think what the Rav is saying, and this goes to what I was discussing with Avi as well, which is that I think that the Rav is not talking about always external action. Sometimes it may be that, but not always. What it is about growing through the experience, through the suffering. What can I do with this to make me a better person? For some people, that might be about political activism or some sort of external kind of set of behaviors that I am going to somehow change. For Eov, that wasn't the case. For Eov, it wasn't the externals, but it was the internals that fundamentally needed a shift. And surely that manifests itself externally, but that wasn't the fundamental point. So it's not so much about internal, external, or passive versus active in the sense of doing something via diem physically, but it's more about using it as an opportunity to transform who I am, and depending on what my shortcomings are, my change will have to be different. For Eov, it was much more about his character. For the contemporary American community, you're right, that's going to be about political activism for Eov. That's where we're going to go. On the former, again, the Rav would say he's not explaining why he's suffering, but it's more about what Eov learned through the experience of suffering. What he learned to do is that not to feel like a wealthy person who stands above and outside the suffering of the needy in front of him, but that he is one of them.
I find that it speaks to me conceptually,
yeah.
you know, and I think it is sort of the message that, you know, that Viktor Frankl gives also in terms of, like, you know, how does one find meaning and create, you know, and the Rav talks, they both, you know, the Rav also talks about dignity, and mm-hmm. Frankl talks about dignity is that, you know, kind of finding, you know, dignity in suffering, mm-hmm. creating that.
Right.
But I think that there is always this part of me that worries a little bit about almost like the privileging of suffering. You know, like somehow like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's that suffering is positive in a
right.
way. You know,
right.
And I mean, it speaks to me conceptually very much so, because I right. think that it's like, I think the Rock really says, like, when you're suffering, you're meant to ask, like,
right.
what can I do differently? You know, right. like, I guess akin to what you were sharing on Yom Kasi Karun, like, that, you know, that Ravaram was saying, mm-hmm. okay, you know, sure, like, happy, you know, state of Israel, but, like, let me be thinking what's not working and what should I be doing differently? Like,
right.
that you should be having these moments that the pain is meant to kind of stimulate.
Mm-hmm.
But there
right.
does become, like, this little
yeah.
bit of feeling like, okay, like, so really I can't be stimulated to grow if I'm not feeling pain.
Right.
So I have to be in pain. I have to actually suffer in order to grow.
Right. So I don't think, right. So the Rav would probably immediately deny that.
No, right. Exactly.
But
except
you're right
there
that there's,
a
there's like a danger
that.
In that or that. Right.
Yeah.
yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
I would say
right.
that the Rav in his critique of Eov is saying that not only was he not asking the what during his suffering, but he wasn't asking the what when everything was going on for him, so that it's not only about asking the what in times of suffering when you're trying to adjust to something as bad as pain.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like his essay on halacha and suffering. I'm thinking of other. I mean, the Rav talks about suffering in other places, not just here. And he and it for him it is this cathartic experience, which it speaks to me. But I'm just saying, I think there is a part of it.
It can like if misunderstood or misapplied, it can lead to almost this like masochistic
right,
kind
exactly.
of
like
conclusion
I need to suffer
where
to grow.
Right, like I can't if I didn't suffer in this kind of way, then I can't
I
really be
right.
You know, I can't reach my potential, something like that. 100%. So that's the Rav's take on the whole story of Eov, which I think really brings home this idea of using the suffering for transformation. And he does it very eloquently. It's a very moving kind of presentation. If you jump now to 62-63, the bottom left, missing the moment. So the Rav now takes this idea of fate and destiny and the responsibility that falls upon us to respond to moments of suffering, and he begins to turn to contemporary issues. And so he writes in the scene titled Missing the Moment, now as well, we are living in troubled times, in days of wrath and distress. We have been victims, the victims of vicious attacks. We have been stricken with suffering. During the last 15 years, okay, so from roughly 1941, right, the beginning of the camps, right? In the last 15 years, we have been afflicted with torments which are unparalleled in the thousands of years of exile, oppression, religious persecution, the era of suffering. This dark chapter in our history did not come to an end with the establishment of the State of Israel. Even now, today, the State of Israel still finds itself in a crisis situation fraught with danger, and we are all filled with fear and trembling regarding the fate of the Yeshua, the struggling Jewish community in the land of Israel. I have to confess, I have a hard time relating to this. I just simply didn't live through a period in time where now we have sort of existential threats from the outside. But I mean, even internally, just that sense of day to day, walking around in the state of Israel and walking around here and seriously questioning what will be next year. Right, that kind of experience, it's foreign to me. And even with Iran, and maybe I don't. Maybe I need to feel more empathy with the fate of our people. But somehow, to me, it just feels different than the Rav is describing in 1956.
Thank God.
Miraculously. Yeah, Barnes, go ahead.
Something is missing here. I don't know if he's going to address it later.
Yeah.
Where the Betachon maybe fits into that? Where's the religious faith and then believing in Hashem to the doing good and meaning good
right.
at any point in the life?
Absolutely.
Because otherwise, you have a.
And it's interesting, it's such a great point, because the Rav does not focus on that in this essay particularly. And I think the reason he doesn't focus on it is because it's both a philosophical essay, but it's a call to action. And I think what the Rav, it's sort of, what he sees as the shortcoming is, you should daven and continue to daven, you should have faith, but that needs to be complemented by activism, doing everything that we can. And I think the Rav sees a lot of Tehillim, and maybe not as much proactive behavior on the, and support on the part of the American Jewish community.
Faith is not just doubt. So, faith is actually what leads you to action, what leads you to actually respond to the circumstances. We can argue
that's interesting.
The day is gone that faith you can't do much about, but what matters is your response to it, what you do based on that. And that may elevate you
and
bury you.
And so,
the difference is, I really believe that.
And what's fascinating is, I think, for the Rav, what he emphasized in this essay is, even though he was a big believer in faith and all that, and he wrote extensively about faith, he focuses more on what he was describing with regard to Eov, is the sense of identity, of shared fate and destiny with our people. And that's really the thrust of this essay, which is interesting, fascinating.
It's a great danger in that book, making suffering like a way of life.
So that's what, that's, yeah.
It's not.
So he's not, he doesn't want that, I think it's fair to say. But in 1956, it was...
I was born yet, but I can tell
Right. Okay. I think my impression is until after the Six-Day War, my sense is, my understanding is that was really the watershed moment. That before that, they were still talking about turning off the lights in Ben-Gurion, and afterward, there was just a restored and renewed sense of confidence, not just the messianism and then everything that went with that, but just the self-confidence of Jews throughout the world. I think that there have been, I don't think there have been academic studies, I wish someone could or would, I'm not sure it's still possible to do this, but even the amount of yarmulke wearing in major Jewish communities, including in American Jewish communities, how that changed after 1967. And I suspect that you'd find a real spike, that things really change in very obvious ways in terms of our self-confidence as a people. And after everything we've gone through, it was necessary. So 1956, I think, we're still in the shadow.
They did a study on just intermarriage rates.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I get this right.
Did it go down in
1960? From 70 to 79. Okay, so between 60 and 69, and then 59 and 70, whatever it is, 10 years during the Six-Day War, and then 10 years later, the intermarriage rate, it stabilized, like it stopped.
It stayed, right.
And then it seems, you know, every time there's a thing, like thing, it stabilizes.
Right,
and it's very interesting.
Right, so that's exactly this. So the Rav goes on to say that the message of the Book of Eov and the message of suffering is that we need to be responsive sometimes in the moment to historical events. That it's not enough to say, okay, so when the time comes and I'm ready to get there, or sometimes I have with high school students, right? Rabbi, when I get to Israel, that's when I'll be from and all that stuff. Or that's when I'll really learn. Now, I'm doing okay. When I get to Israel, that's when it's going to happen. Right? In the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot and the Rambam Echo, we don't say that, right? Don't say, later on. Later on when I have time, Shema lo tipane. It says there are no guarantees in life. You can't say, I'll get there when I get there, right? The time is now. So the Rav goes on to trace a number of instances in biblical narratives and then in halakha, in which we say that taking advantage of that opportunity in the moment, seizing the moment, is an essential thing to do. So, for example, he points to two outstanding kings in the early stages of Jewish history who both sinned. You have Shaul on the one hand, and you have David HaMelech on the other. Shaul sins on two occasions. First, he's meant to wait 7 full days until the Navi Shmuel returns in order to offer a sacrifice and to feast, and on the seventh day in the afternoon, he jumps ahead and he begins to eat. And that's sinful. He didn't wait all the entire time for Shmuel to come. And then, more egregious is the story of Amalek, where he gives in both cases, actually. What's interesting is he gives in to the pressure of the people, and he says, they wouldn't allow me to kill all the Amalekites, and he spared Agag and others as well. And so you have these shortcomings on the part of Shaul. And David Amalek, Melech, the story incident of Bathsheba, right, we have a tragic episode where he essentially sends the husband to the front lines, is together with what would appear to be at that time a married woman, a horrific sin. Shaul loses his kingdom, David does not. If anything, one could argue for the reverse. Right? Why this distinction? Says the Rav, it's very simple. When the Navi approaches Shaul, well, it was the people, it was this, it was that, everything but me. And then when the Navi pushes him further, finally Shaul says, you know what, you're right, I messed up, I'm not going to do it again. On both occasions. David HaMelech, when he's approached by Natan HaNavi, what's his response? Chatati. Read Perek Nun Aleph, I believe, of Tehillim, and you read the tshuva of David HaMelech. It is heart-wrenching. It is shocking in the intensity of its emotional force. There is an immediate response. There's an immediate admission. There's no rationalization. Says the Rav, the difference between someone who loses his kingdom and someone who keeps his kingdom is not a question of whether or not you sinned. You can have two sets of sins. The question is, when approached by the prophet, do you immediately say, you know what, I messed up, or the excuses for him, for etc., and only later on. So taking advantage of that opportunity in that moment can sometimes make all the difference in the world. And it's true, so I just want to add one point, what's true in the case of Tanakh is true in the halachic discipline as well. So the Rav says, I'm lighting candles, and it's Friday afternoon, it's Friday evening. One moment I light Friday candle, right? I light the candles, I've fulfilled a mitzvah. Just a few moments later, at worst, Chayav Mita violated essentially a cardinal sin. It's just a difference of a few moments, a few seconds. But Judaism, not losing the opportunity, the difference in just a few seconds can make all the difference in the world. Like, Boris, did you have
a question? Whether the Navi would make true if the Navi didn't confront him.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big question.
Yeah, what was it?
If the Navi didn't confront him,
what would David HaMelech
do? Do the truth. That's
it. He read a novel, I don't know. A couple of novels have been written, but we don't know what would have happened if history happened differently, right? Lots of books like that. Yeah, but yes. Alicia, do you have
This issue or this nafkamina between David and Shaul,
yeah,
of doing tshuva immediately, or Danny, how does that tie in with the previous chapter on the destiny on the Brit Hebrews? It's not quite the same thing. It's kind of more of an ala tshuva.
Right. No, it's not.
No, but you change your destiny.
But the point is,
destiny is where you're getting from that point of.
Right. Well, what the Rav is saying is someone who undergoes suffering is charged to move from fate to destiny, but it's not enough to just kind of get there. Sometimes you have to respond immediately, in the moment, seize that opportunity. And that's really his point. You can't just say, well, we'll get there. It's got to be right away. And then the Rav continues in terms of different examples, and he comes to the case of Shir HaShirim. On the bottom of 66. And he asks, so beautifully, what is the gist of the Song of Songs if not the description of the tragic and paradoxical delay of the Shulamite maiden, drunk with love and overwhelmed with yearning, when a favorable moment, replete with awe and majesty, beckoned to her, if not her missing that great, exalted, and momentous opportunity that she had dreamed about, fought for, and sought so passionately. Right, so in other words, right, Shir HaShirim, but there's the love story, there's the opportunity for them to see each other and to be together, right? And so that's the moment that quickly approaches. The tender and delicate Shulamite maiden, impelled by her longing for a bright-eyed beloved, roamed during sun-drenched days through the bypaths of vineyards and over the crests of mountain, through fields and gardens, and during pale, magical, moonlit nights, during pitch-black nights between the walls, searching for her beloved. Again, the line for the Rav between prose and poetry is razor thin, right? He crosses over very quickly from one to the other. Gorgeous. One cold and rainy night, she returned to her tent, tired and worn out, and fell fast asleep. The sound of quick and light footsteps could be heard in the silence of the tent. On that strange and mysterious night, suddenly, the beloved emerged from out of the dark and knocked on the door of his darling, who had intensely yearned for and awaited him. He knocked and pleaded with her to open the door of her tent. It is the voice of my beloved that knocketh. open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my undefiled, for my head is filled with dew, my locks with the drops of night, the great moment that she had been looking forward to, with such impatience and longing, materialized unexpectedly. Her elusive, self-concealing beloved, tired of wandering and hardships, appeared with his curly hair, black eyes, powerful build, radiant countenance. He stood by her door, stretched his hand in through the hole in the latch, sought refuge from the damp of night. I wished to tell her about his powerful love, about his desires and yearnings, about a life of companionship filled with delight and joy. And it continues only the slight movement of stretching out her hand and turning the latch into V between her and her beloved. Right? With her single leap, the Shulamite maiden could have obtained her heart's longings. Draw me, we will run after thee. But the heart is deceitful, and who could discern it? Precisely on that night, a strange, stubborn indolence overcame her. For a fierce moment, the fire of longing that had burned so brightly was dimmed, the fierce passion ebbs, and so on and so forth. I'm sorry, I missed up the continuation. But she can. He continues and he describes that this incredible experience, right? This overwhelming sense of emotion, for whatever reason, almost irrationally, somehow she didn't go forward, right? She hears the knock on the door. She doesn't go to open it. It's inexplicable. We don't know why. And then what happens? All of a sudden, she overcomes this insanity. She realizes what she's done. So what does she do? She quickly gets herself dressed. She goes to the door to open it. And of course, by the time she gets there, right, it's gone. So the Rav says, this is a biblical story of missed opportunities. This is a biblical story of a knock at the door. And if you wait just a moment too long, if you don't seize the opportunity to move from fate to destiny immediately, to seize your destiny, you might find that the moment will be lost.
That's why it's in the moment. You have to be always living in the moment, because it's not about looking back mm-hmm. all the time and saying, oh, I missed that opportunity. Oh, that's what that was. Or
right.
This is what happened. It's about what's happening every minute.
I'm going to pull this up there.
It's unfolding constantly. Because you said the great moment she had looked forward to with such impatience and longing materialized unexpectedly.
Right.
So you're waiting, but you didn't expect him.
Right. So I don't think the Rav is saying, maybe this is what you're saying as well. I don't think he's saying that it's always happening. I think
is
that
you should live like it could be.
Well, that's it. I think it could happen at any moment in time.
Right.
And we should never get so comfortable as she gets that when the opportunity comes our way, that we just pass up on it. So we should always be alert to those possibilities. But I think for the Rav in this essay, there are specific concrete experiences. Not like everything in life is kind of like this. There are moments in our life when there are opportunities, when things come our way, when things are different, and it's our responsibility to stand up and to respond appropriately.
The idea that you're always living in suffering mm-hmm. is being elevated.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's that you're taking suffering and you're always elevating it. You're not saying, oh, what was me? Mm-hmm. Me?
I've read a lot of the Rav. I know
no,
what
he does
you said.
A lot about that,
right.
But
he talks
it's not.
About,
but I think it's about because there are people who will. It's more like. Confronting it, you know, just acknowledging it that this is bad. You know, not avoiding it.
All right. So then, and we're going to start this, but we won't be able to finish it, so we'll have to conclude. We'll have to conclude next time. But the Rav then takes this imagery, and this is again where the Rav mixes between theology, poetry, and beautiful imagery. It's just gorgeous. Just what he does with this is genius. The Rav then takes this imagery of the knock at the door, and the Rav says, "Have we responded to the knocks at our door?" As a people, our beloved has been knocking at the door. Did we get up and answer when we had the chance? And the Rav, in almost brilliant oratorical style, you can hear him. I mean, can you imagine being in the room with him? You hear him, right? Each one, it's the voice, right? Kol dodido fake. You can hear him saying the words. It's really incredible. So the Rav actually writes exactly this. He says, I apologize, not here. I'm going to read it. I have it in front of me. He says, 8 years ago, in the midst of a night of terror, filled with the horrors of Majdanek, Treblinka, and Buchenwald, Grunewald in a night of gas chambers and crematoria, in a night of absolute divine self-consumment, hester panim muchlat, and so on and so forth. So he says, in that very night, the beloved appeared. God, who conceals himself in his dazzling hiddenness, suddenly manifested himself and began to knock at the tent of his desponding and disconsolate love, twisting convulsively on her bed, suffering the pains of hell. As a result of the knocks on the door of the maiden, wrapped in mourning, the state of Israel was born. Now, the Rav wants to be, I think, careful, although he doesn't qualify here, because I guess maybe this is getting to the crescendo. I'll qualify. I don't think that the Rav is saying that the two are conceptually linked. I don't think that the Rav ever endorsed the kind of view that said that somehow the state of Israel was... Right, was a tikkun of the Holocaust, or that the Holocaust allowed for, paved the way, or that was somehow a higher purpose. God, from my perspective, God forbid, I can't speak for the Rav, but that's certainly not what he's saying here. But what he is saying is that somehow, almost inconceivably, at that very same time, in the ashes of the Holocaust, somehow we had these incredible moments of completely unexpected divine revelation. Almost where the hester panim, that divine hiddenness, somehow ceased to be complete, and there were these glimpses behind the curtain, if one uses the Shir HaShirim imagery, these knocks at the door that all of a sudden awakened us, that were shocking because of their timing. They were the moments when we least expected them after those six incredibly dark years, and yet here they were. So I think that's basically what the Rav is saying. And what the Rav does is he goes on to list six knocks that he believes, that he identifies over the course of the last number of years that are related to the founding of the State of Israel. And there are some beautiful passages. We're not going to have time to go through it tonight, so we're going to stop here because our time is up. Just a heads up, next week we're not having the regular learning because Dr. Aviva Zornberg is coming on Wednesday night. All are more than welcome to come. She just published her new book on Bamidbar as well. So that's out. We'll be selling them. She'll be autographing them if you'd like. She's a real superstar, so that's really exciting. We'll be continuing, God willing, with the six knocks 2 weeks from tonight. Thank you.